Hi, it's Gus Warland here, host of Not an Overnight Success, the only podcast in the world that gives every guest $10,000 to give away to a charity of their choice, all thanks to our mates at Shaw & Partners Financial Services. Today, it's Ali Langdon, someone who's quite serious, but I'm sure you're going to see this side of her, the fun country girl who was just so vulnerable, so much fun as well. I really enjoyed this chat.
Ali Langdon, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Good to see you, Gus. You're looking good.
Thank you. 20 kilos down as of this morning. Got onto the scales and went, come on, you know, because I'd stopped at about 18 and I thought, oh, I'm doing all this hard work. But yeah, it went over 20.4 down.
Wow. You know, because it's always those last couple that are the hardest to shake, right?
Yes, that's what they say.
Yeah. It's getting a little tougher now,
getting a little tougher now, definitely. I'm saying no to way too many things. Ali, this is a very relaxed chat and it's so nice to see you. Tell us about Ali as a young child. Where'd you grow up? What sort of kid were you?
Grew up in country New South Wales, small town called Warhope. We grew up on a little farm. And you know what? As a kid, really focused. Really, just really well behaved. Right. I think I had an older brother who was a total scallywag. I think he was voted like most likely to end up in jail at high school. And he didn't. I mean, I reckon maybe gone close a couple of times, but no, he was fine. But I think, you know, watching him just, and watching my mum and dad tear their hair out, just, you know, him just being a boy. I mean, nothing bad, but just being a boy.
Yeah.
Whatever that means.
Hard work at times.
Hard work. So I just kind of, you know, went through and, I mean, I was the weird kid. I loved school. Ah. I loved school. I did ballet before and after school every day. And so, you know, at school, uni was a different story, but well, those early days, just really, really focused on, you know, what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go.
And were you good at school?
Yeah,
like
I was.
At the actual, like, work, were you getting A's and that sort of thing?
I was, and I remember my little sister, who's 3 years younger, once stole one of my geography tests in year 10 that I got 98% for. So she, and it was a teacher who always gave the same exams every year.
Yeah.
So she found mine and just wrote it out in her own handwriting and she only got like 80%. So she always reckons it was rigged and that I'm not as smart as I thought I was.
You know what? I've got exactly the same story. So Hugh Jackman and I at Knox together. Yeah. I got put into the top modern history class because I was a little slower and they thought that Jacko and another couple of mates would be able to help me through it. Well, we got Ian Jackman, which is Jacko's brother, who's now, I think, the youngest QC or judge or something, literally in the last couple of months. He got a 20 out of 20 modern history, the unification of Germany it was. So Jacko wrote it out. I wrote it out. Jacko got 18. I got 12 out of 20. I'm like, he literally looked at the name Gus Warland. Yeah, 10, 11, 12, 13. We'll give him a 12.
Didn't even read it.
18, you know, so I know that definitely does happen with some teachers. So you were good at school, you were ballet, were you sporty as well?
Yeah, I was sporty, but, you know, I loved sort of playing whatever we played with PE and, you know, play netball and a bit of basketball, but I focused on ballet. So I finished, you know, my ballet exams when I was in high school and then did my teacher's certificate when I was in year 11 and 12. And you know what? I look back and, you know, growing up in a small country town, it kept me out of trouble.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be at ballet every sort of Friday night quite late. I'd be up early Saturday and I'd teach most of Saturdays. So if I went to a party and we lived out on a farm, I'd drive the little yellow Corolla, which I had to buy myself. You know, my parents like, you want a car, you buy it. So
really? No love from mum and dad? Didn't throw you a bone?
No. It didn't throw me a bone. It threw none of us a bone. But, you know, I'd saved. I'd been saving since I was 14. I was also that kid, you know, at Easter time when – that I'd have to throw my Easter eggs out because I'd keep them so long, which was just to annoy my brother and sister. Can you imagine how annoying I was?
Oh, yeah.
So annoying.
Yeah.
Come home, getting good grades, just doing the right thing and, you know.
Being a ballet teacher, being so nice and not eating your eggs.
Yep.
That is, yeah, that would annoy me, definitely.
Not sure I had a lot of friends, though.
Yeah. I was going to ask you that. Like, did you have mates with ballet or were you so sort of Captain Sensible that you were a bit more of a solo?
Always just a small group of pals, close to all the girls that I danced with, and they were like a little bit older, but always enjoyed time on my own. I was quite happy sort of doing my own thing and all. And, you know, it's funny too, like you look back and you know, in your school days and there's always a little part of you that looks over to that cool crowd. And then, you know, but I look back now and I've still got those same mates that I had from school and they're pretty special relationships actually.
Yeah, they're the best. They're the ones that know everything and you feel like you can chat about anything without any fear of judgment.
And you know what? Doesn't matter where our life has gone or where we're living or how long since we've seen each other, we're exactly the same when you get back together.
Yeah.
You know, I remember my very first school reunion and, you know, we're sitting in the gutter at 1 o'clock in the morning with our shoes off, you know, eating a kebab. It's like, yeah, none of us have changed. Yeah.
We're just a bit older.
Just a bit older. Yeah. Not really wiser, but just a bit older.
Are they, if I had all your sort of best pals in a room, would they be proud of you, do you think? Do you think they'd be proud of turning on the telly at, you know, in the evenings now and seeing you up there?
I think they're proud that I'm doing something that I love and, you know, they remember even as a kid that I wanted to be a journalist, so that I don't think they care that I'm on telly. In fact, I know they don't care that I'm on telly, yeah. You know, and that's what good friends are, right? They just sort of know you for who you are and know that I'm doing the thing that I always set out to do and wanted to do, and luckily I love it as much as I'd always hoped that I would, so they're just happy about that.
Yeah, you're living your dream, literally.
So, well, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'm just trying to think back when I was trying to get the kids to school in the morning. I mean, is that the dream?
No, I know what you mean. But at the end of the day, you've done really well. And I know with all friends of mine that have done well, whether they're super famous or just good people doing what they wanted to do, it's just really lovely to have that in your group of mates.
And they know you for who you are, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's true friendship. Were you close to your brother and sister growing up?
Yeah.
And your mum and dad, what were they like as parents?
Oh, my, two of the best humans on the planet. I love them. I mean, and to give you a sense of dad, you know, if anything was ever wrong, I mean, my kids say it now too. It's like, there's no sooking unless there's blood. That's the rule in our house.
Right.
And, you know, Scout had a really bad fall the other day and she came in and she's four and it's like, there's no blood, but it really hurts. And it's like, okay, you can sook, it's fine.
So she got the term out.
She's got,
that's good.
I know I'm not meant to because there's no blood, but
that's so cute.
Yeah. But growing up, Dad was always, if there was ever a problem, there were two things that would fix it, a swim or a poo. And, and typically, I reckon 95% of the time he was right.
That's so good.
Yeah. But it was, it was just lovely just growing up on the farm. And Dad, he worked casually, so he didn't really ever take holidays. But we had the farm.
Mm.
And so we're out bush all the time. And so we didn't, you know, I think I remember going on holidays in the car, the Mazda 323 all the way to Queensland with a sister who got car sick in the middle to the Gold Coast. And I remember every detail of that holiday. I remember the smells. Mm. I remember the room where we stayed. And that was sort of, you know, that was the big holiday when we were 12. But so many adventures on the farm.
That sounds good. Was it a working farm?
Look, not really. We had those horses and bush. So we had, you know, there were bikes and horses and every animal we named. So.
Oh. Well, that makes it hard to.
I mean, the calf was Meatworks. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we did eat Meatworks, but we didn't know until after.
Was he delicious? Or?
No, it was traumatic because I remember my brother knew about it. He's 3 years older than me. And I don't know, I reckon I would have been 12. My sister would have been 9 and he was 15. And mum and dad said, oh, we're sending, you know, Meatworks to a bigger farm, and it made sense to us, even though, you know, it was like 25 acres.
He seemed to have plenty of room.
Seemed to be a lot of room with one freaking calf. Yeah. And then my brother dropped it after dinner one night, like, you know, how was dinner? It's like, oh, it was really yum. It's like, ha ha, you have Meatworks. And my sister and I were bawling. Oh. My brother got walloped. And like, we didn't get hit much. Like, I mean, the threat of a smack used to exist, but it didn't happen very much. But yeah, he did for this one. And then after that, every time, like, you know, we had chicken for dinner, I'd make mum show me, like, the Steggles pack that had it come from the chook shed. And, you know, we'd go and do a head count of all our lambs to make sure that, you know, the roast dinner on Sunday wasn't little Frisky or Bambi.
I can just imagine you and your sister doing that.
Oh.
Right, chicken. Okay. Go. 1, 2, 3.
It was traumatic.
But it sounds like you had a wonderful sort of upbringing. But all the way through it, you speak about this love for ballet and love for journalism. So was there any point in your life where you went, you know what, I could be a ballerina?
Look, there was always that thought when I finished school to go and do that for a little while. But then when I got into university, you couldn't defer it. It was at Charles Sturt, which is out in Bathurst.
Yep.
And they don't take too many journalism students each year. So I got into that. And look, it was one of those things. It would have been lovely to have gone and have done it. And, you know, as Mum says, she talks about how much money
went into the
well, you know, like, you know, new pair of point shoes every 6 weeks and how much money went into a Stedford's and performances and costumes and lessons and trips to Sydney and what have you. It would have been nice to go and do something, but I don't ever feel like I've missed out on that. Like I loved it, but I wasn't ever going to, you know, be a principal artist for the Australian Ballet, you know?
Okay. You're good, but you weren't like, oh my God, this is the greatest ballerina Australia's ever seen.
No, you didn't miss out on that. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you haven't seen it, so I could just say that.
Yeah.
I mean, I may have been, Gus.
Yes, and given the right tutelage, you might
exactly.
have got there.
Exactly. I mean, who knows? But yeah. No, it was something I loved, and you know, the teaching side of it was great. But I was when I then went to uni and I shifted, you know, all my focus to sort of journalism. I say shifted my focus. I think we did 10 hours face to face, and my parents said, keeping in mind how good I was in high school.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a single photo of you at uni, Ali, without a drink in your hand. And it's true.
So you broke out a little.
I broke out.
You found a different you.
Well, I found a different, yeah. There was probably a bit of freedom that came with it that, you know, that I was so hard on myself in the final years of school.
Mm.
And, you know, and I see mates and their kids going through year 12 now and, you know, how hard exams are and their anxiety levels. Like I still have dreams about turning up to my HSC maths exam and realizing I haven't been to any classes all year. Like, you know, I'm 44.
Yeah.
I still have dreams or nightmares about the HSC. So,
wow.
You know, it's a tough time for kids.
I made a bit of a boo-boo perhaps, but I'd do it again to my old school. I was invited in to talk to the guys before the exams and I said to them, it just doesn't matter at the end of the day. It's just a number. Just work hard, do the best you can. You can always get in a couple of years, go and marry a stranger, kiss a stranger, sleep with a stranger overseas and come back when you're a bit older. They'll let you in. It's okay. You can see the teachers looking at me going, not really what we're
this
after.
Is not what we invited him here to say.
Well, that's right.
But it is so, so true. But I also have this thought that I mean, my parents, they never pushed us and, you know, if they'll have whatever we came home with, it's like, did you work as hard as you could? Whatever that grade was, they were happy.
Yeah.
And I love that about them. And they were at wit's end. They said, you were just a nightmare in year 12. And like dad had come in.
Because you're so worried about yourself.
Well, I'm up at 1 o'clock in the morning eating like straight coffee granules out of, you know, the Nescafe. Sitting there studying. It was like, oh man. And she said, Mum says, you were, you know, you think you're a good kid. You were that year.
Yeah, they were worried about you.
We all wanted to move out. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
so what really did you stressful. What did you get? Like, did you get enough?
Like a 97 something.
Yeah.
Did fine.
Did fine. Did okay.
But I did. It's one of those things where it's funny. I can't believe we're talking about going back to year 12. But like 10 units counted, and so I did 15 just in case I stuffed some of them up. So I have this incredible workload just in
That's
case.
That's 2.5 subjects more than you
yeah,
needed.
Yeah, I know.
To.
I'm well aware of how much.
So
more
I did
it
10.
Was.
I did 10 units as well.
Yes.
Well, 10 units counted. I did 10. Solid 10, backed myself. I backed myself. Society and culture was one of the two.
Okay.
And that was literally half the mark was a thing called a personal interest project where you could write about whatever you wanted to write about for 2 years.
See, you're smart and efficient. It was nothing about what I did was efficient. But,
no, but you got the job done.
Got it done.
But obviously a big deep breath. You get to university and you see, okay, perhaps I need a bit more balance.
And I probably went a little bit too far the other way.
Yeah, yeah. So how long did it take? Because it normally happens, you're one way, you swing back too much, and then you come back to the sensible centre.
Yeah.
How long at uni did you come back? Year 2, 3?
I reckon, yeah, maybe sort of halfway through second year.
Yeah.
Got a bit more focus again.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you realise then that you were quite good at this journalism thing and you were like, I actually do love it as much as I was hoping? Like, at what stage did
I
don't, it really?
I wasn't very good at all, no. And I mean, I had in my third year, I had a scholarship with Channel 7. And a mate of mine, John, had the Channel 9 scholarship. And then I finished and everyone who ever had the Channel 7 scholarship got a job with them. And I didn't. They didn't want me.
Oh.
I know, it was quite
Was it a straight up meeting face to face, like you and I looking at each other now?
Yeah, just never, never happened. Sort of, you know, I was doing a bit of work experience in third year, and there was no interest. And then I ended up doing work experience at Channel 9, and
Worked out, still there.
22 years later, I'm still there.
So the seven thing doesn't work out, but you do a bit with nine.
Yep.
Nine take you on. And what sort of role are you playing at that stage at nine? Like straight out of uni, working at nine, what are you doing?
I was a producer on Nightline, which was the late news. Jim Whaley was the newsreader.
Okay.
Hugh Remington was the reporter. And it was this fabulous team. When you know, it was the early, not early days, but, you know, the good days of TV, as they're often referred to now. And so the 6 p.m. desk would leave and Brian Henderson would go home, and the crew was only half hour news then. We'd go straight up to the third floor, which was, you know, the executive level, go straight to the bar, get, you know, a couple of bottles of wine, platter of cheese, and we'd all put the news to air, you know, riding away and doing our thing. And it was fantastic. So just being in this world of adults and
Sounds awesome.
Listening to all these oldies tell, you know, all their oldies and probably my age now.
Yeah.
Seemed old anyway. Just telling all their war stories, and it just learned so much. And it was such a great introduction. And what I loved is they had so much time to share their wisdom.
Mm.
And so there's so many lessons from those early days that I've still got in my mind, like, you know, certain things I don't like when people write. It's like, that's lazy writing, because I remember being told that when I was, you know, in my early 20s. Mm. And it's sort of, and it's stuck, and, you know, you pass that on now. And
yeah,
I don't know if they appreciate it or not, but.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's probably good advice. So whether you like it or not, take it on board. Jim Whaley's daughter is now my producer at Triple M on The Drive Show.
You're kidding.
Nikki, I don't know if you knew Nikki, but Nikki's now, yeah, she's been in and around Triple M forever and done wonderful stuff all around the world, but she's come back and now she's our producer and she's an absolute legend. So I hear a lot about her dad.
Mm.
So you're doing that and you're like, okay, this all seems to be going along nicely. At what stage do you get the next step? At what point do you get in front of the camera, or was that a moment that came a little later?
I worked on Nightline for a while, and then they shifted me to the 6 p.m. news, which is one of the scariest things in the world, working for Brian Henderson. I mean, most lovely, beautiful, beautiful man, but just the icon.
Yeah, Brian told me.
Exactly. And I mean, he was wonderful to work with too. And so I think I did that job. And it's funny, even looking back now, like I look at the newsroom and mainly made up of women, young women, a lot of working mums. And I went back to that point. There was myself and one other female on that production desk. Everyone else was all men. It was just a very, very different environment back then. So I do love how, and no one, if anyone had babies, they left. It was kind of.
Never to be seen again.
It was a bit like that. Yeah. But that's, you know, that's 20 years ago. And thankfully now, like, you know, they all work rosters and thank goodness that's all changed.
Yeah.
But yeah, then I just decided I wanted an adventure. So I went up to Darwin, and I worked up in Darwin as a reporter for just under 2 years. And, you know, that was pretty fun, rocking up on a flight right before, like 2 days before Christmas, landing at 11 o'clock at night. I think it was the night of their Christmas party.
Right.
And they were all sideways. And I just left all my stuff in a car and went to this party and met them all and thought, I think I'm going to enjoy this. I mean, it's a bit, I remember one of the old guys who worked there just came up to me and goes, mate, I'll lose some of his colourful language. But he basically effectively said, it's hot. It's always hot. You don't whinge about the heat. You'll have a bloody good time, with a lot of extra words in between. Yeah. And it was, I loved it up there. And some of my greatest mates now, like three of my closest friends are girls that I met up there.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah.
So was that a change for you to go from producer to being a reporter on air? Was that a decision you really wanted, or did you want to get a bit of a feel for everything before you made your mind up on where you wanted to, you know, really do the great work?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, I started at uni. I always thought I wanted to be a print journalist. And then I think in second year you have to split it. So you have to either do broadcast or print, and just broadcast looked like fun. So I thought, I'll go down, I'll do that. And I figure, well, we'll learn to write there anyway, so I could, you know, shift across. But yeah, I don't think it was ever, it's the storytelling part. And that's like when we have work experience kids who come in, kids, you know, the young adults, when they come in and it's like, you know, what do you want to do? And I always know the ones that are going to make it, and because it's, oh, It's about the job. It's about the storytelling. And it's not the ones who go, I want to be on TV.
Right.
You know, it's yes, that is the job, but what you've got to love is the journalism and the story and that connection that you make with people. A big part of the job is not just how you talk to someone, is how you convince them or get them to trust you to actually sit down and tell you their story.
Yeah.
That's a big part of it. I mean, it's a big part of what you do. It's what you're doing right now.
Yeah.
To me. Yeah. I don't know how I feel about being on the other side of it. But, yeah. You know, in a minute, I've got some questions for you.
Well, it's sort of being authentic and real. Yeah. And I think we've always wanted that, but COVID made it even like fast forward to it. Like, yeah. I'm just not going to put up with it anymore. Like, I'm just going to hang with people that are real and authentic.
Yeah.
And have my life with those sort of people, because as we've been proven, it can really go up sideways in a hurry.
Did you strip your life back then during COVID?
Like, definitely.
Who was in your life?
I had the same bunch of mates. We're called the nonstop gibberers, you know, yeah. and someone that you know, Grant Andrews, is one of those guys. Yeah. We've all been best men to each other, groomsmen to each other. We all love each other. We're all godfather. There's 13 of us in total, and we've known each other. I've known 8 of the 13 for over 50 years. I'm 55 in December. So these blokes are like brothers, my chosen brothers. I've got a brother who I love, but these are my chosen brothers. And absolutely, we love a little bit of stage 3 lockdown. You know, we love that, where we could still get together, but not necessarily. We had to be like a meter or so apart, and we had to take away from the cafe. Didn't bother us at all where we were on the beaches. We just grabbed our coffee, egg and bacon roll, and sat and looked at Collaroy. It was fantastic, but we got ourselves through that. And then we saw the world quickly fasten up again. And I got involved in it probably quicker than the other guys.
Yeah.
And all before I knew it, I was going quicker than I was before. And we do talk about that time being a time that was precious.
Mm. But I think there are two sides to that, right? Like, you know, you talk about everything, you had to strip everything back so life was simpler. But you could still go to the beach every day.
Yeah.
You could still look at the ocean. Mm. And it just depends where that lockdown was, right?
Yeah. My cousin in Victoria, you know, he looks at me, you know, he's had that 5-kilometre radius around his house. And then they had, you know, really awful time there for a long time. So everyone had their own experiences. And in England, a lot of my wife's family and friends, they had an awful time with it as well. So everyone had their own stuff. But I'm glad we're out of it. Mm. I just wish we could take a few of the lessons that we learned and just took a little chill pill.
I think you're right. And I think that's the one thing, like, we're just clocking at the moment is just how to get so fast again.
Yeah.
It just feels really, really fast. I mean, and if we just look at what we've seen over the last couple of weeks. So obviously, you know, my work side is you cycle.
Yeah.
And this has been one of the toughest runs I think we've had in what we've been exposed to and what we've been talking about and, you know, the division we've seen and just the angst worldwide as to what comes next.
Yeah.
But then I look at home, just like, how did it just get so full, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, like now it's just like, okay, like 5 weeks, we have nothing in the diary for that weekend. Let's keep it free.
Good
and
luck.
And it's like, I know, but I mean, no, we will.
Oh, you are.
But it's like, how is it that, like, I don't know, just.
Yeah. Well, having kids, you know, and having lives and your husband's got a life, like you're all busy. So it just happens.
Yeah. He has too much of a life, by the way.
Okay.
We'll talk. I'd like him to have less.
Okay, we'll talk about him in a moment. And you have turned it around. You started asking me stuff. So, okay. So you're there, you're up in Darwin, you have a great time. You meet those three people that are lifelong friends still to today. How does that girl go to becoming someone who is in war-torn places, who is literally putting their life at risk to give the story telling that you talk about? Was it something that you went for, or was it just something you found? Were you scared when you went to war-torn countries?
Yeah, look, certainly there was definitely a heightened sense of danger. And so I think coming back from Darwin and coming into the newsroom in Sydney, I'd always wanted 60 minutes. That was the job I wanted. And at one point when I came back, it was, they sort of, you know, were sort of shifting me into more of like a news reading role. But that's not what I wanted to do at that point at all. That wasn't where my interest lied. 60's the gig I wanted. And so then I got that. I was 30, which was pretty young.
Yeah.
Tell
us the day that they told you. Like, did you get a phone call or did they call you into the office? Like,
I don't remember.
What?
I remember my first day walking in there. I don't remember how I was told the news. But it was one of those, holy, hell moments.
Yeah.
And then just feeling like a total fraud.
Of course.
You know, I walk into the office and it's like, hi, Liz Hayes. Hi, Tara. And I'd known Tara for years and, you know, loved her. And she was so extraordinary when I came in, even to the point of like, if you need help to pack and what to pack, because you go away for 6 weeks at a time. It's like, you know, and some half of it might be in freezing cold weather and the other half hot. You know, she says, even if you're just worried about what shoes to take, you know, nothing's too silly. Ask me whatever.
Mm.
And if you've got any questions about an interview or something, you know, and I'm always appreciative of that. But you also look around the room and the producers on the show then were just as famous as all the reporters. You had Howard Sakers and Stephen Rice and Gareth Harvey and Nick Greenaway and Stephen Taylor. These are names, if you work, it mean nothing to anyone.
Okay? Yeah, but gurus.
But just, yeah, just, and so I was just really, really nervous even working with them.
Mm.
And there was a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't sound like 60 minutes and, you know, I didn't act like 60 minutes. You know, it was tricky at the start, but there was one particular producer, Nick, who just, he goes, mate, you're you. We've got you in because you're you and because you're different. So just ignore the noise. And he was a bit of a protector. It was great. And just do you. And he goes, I'll deal with this bit, you know. And I'm appreciative of that because, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, in those early days, it's like, oh, gee, okay, how do I do this? And how do I sound like Liz? It's like, well, I don't need another bloody Liz. And no one can sound like Liz.
Yeah. Liz does a good job of being Liz.
You know, she's fine there. We don't need to. Yeah, but, you know, so that just comes around to confidence. But moving from news to 60, where it's like, well, hang on, I can tell any story in a minute 20. And now all of a sudden I have 20 minutes. Like, I don't need 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's just a whole new skill set to learn. And I reckon that part, the writing of scripts, took me maybe even a couple of years.
So you write your own stuff. There's no one there to help you with that.
Oh, you'd write on 60, you'd write them together with your producer. You always write together and people do different things. But, you know, Liz, Tara and myself always wrote our own scripts, you know.
Okay.
Because also you write all your interviews, you have an idea how this story is going to go, you're there on the road. You know, if you hand it over and someone else does it and then you look at the final product and go, well, that's not what I wanted or what
that's
I
not my
thought.
Words, yeah.
Yeah, then, well.
It's on you.
Tough titties because you didn't, you know, you didn't do the hard yards. So, you always see your story through because, you know, at the end of the day, our stories, we feel them and they're important to us and you want to get them right. And I think, you know, a lot of that is that you have people often at their most vulnerable moment trusting you to deliver their story. And for me, the most important thing is, not even what do the bosses think? Are they going to like this? Is this what they wanted? Because that, at the end of the day, is the most important thing.
Yeah.
That you do the right thing by the person who's trusted you to tell their story. That's a big deal. That's a big deal for me.
Of course, you can see it in your face as you say it. Do you ever actually go and sit with those people? Have you had an opportunity to go back and show them the work before it goes on the telly at night? Or do you check in with them after to make sure that they're happy? How's that go? Right.
Always. And I mean, there was a story I did about 13 years ago on a woman called Julie Randall, who was pretty much the first person in Australia to survive stage 4 advanced melanoma. I did a story with her at the time and I always talked to her about, like, you know what? If you'd been diagnosed a couple of months either side, we would never have met. A few months earlier, she wouldn't be here. A few months later, she wasn't that extraordinary because others were surviving. And she rang the other day because her daughter, who was in the story and was no way old enough to be having a baby, she's got her first grandchild.
Wow.
You know, and I stay in contact with, you know, a lot of the families.
That's great. I love the fact you do that. So 60 minutes, you're there, you got a little bit of, oh, I'm not quite sure if I'm good enough. Mm. You get through that. At what stage do you actually walk into that office again and go, I deserve to be here. I've proven myself within yourself, because no doubt your colleagues are all looking and going, oh, yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
But for your own mind, how long did it take you to feel that?
I'm not sure I ever reached that point, if I'm perfectly honest.
Do you feel that now going on to on?
Always. We can always be better. And I think the day that you kind of cruise into the office and, oh, I've got this, is the day you stop trying and pushing yourself to be better. And I'm always really mindful that I might feel really strongly about something but not everyone does. And so it doesn't mean you don't share your opinion, but really are respectful in the way you deliver that. And you always do this really well. When you would be on the Today Show and I'd be on the Today Show with you, you'd never shy away from having an opinion about something. But there's a way to deliver it where you're not sitting there saying something in meaning I'm right and therefore if you don't agree with me,
you must be wrong.
You're wrong. Yeah, yeah. So I'm always really, really mindful of that. And, you know, I've got good people in my life that I can bounce ideas off and we get a good sense of that. But, yeah, I don't know what the hell you asked me. I feel like that went in a totally weird direction.
No, that's what this podcast is all about. I mean, for me, it's
weird directions.
It's been curious in life.
Yeah.
As soon as I came up with I'm just going to be curious on why they feel that way, it just took away a little of the edge of what I thought was right and it gave me enough of a human feel to go, well, they feel something different, so why? And then you're curious enough and you're not standing there going, you know, I'm right and you're wrong.
Yep.
If you're curious in life, I think it gives you more opportunity to find out all the facts.
Mm. And then make whatever decision.
That's right. And also realizing, having enough guts, like I do the radio show now and, you know, we're hardly doing hard-hitting stuff, but when we need to, we have a prime minister on or a premier on, we have to ask the questions that people, as if they were asking it. You can't shy away from that. And I find it difficult. I'm working on it all the time.
Yeah.
But I also find that exhausting. And it must be exhausting for you too, not to be able to walk in and just do your thing. You always want to be better, to always want to strive and always want to improve. That's tiring.
Yeah, it is. But there's also that fabulous feeling you have afterwards when you know you've done a good job. When you look at something and then it depends. When you look at what the feedback is, like with a political interview, if half of them think you're like a right-leaning loony and then the other half think you're a left-leaning loony, then, you know, I was fair and I was down the middle and that's what you want. You can do that and be respectful. I mean, sometimes a bit of argy-bargy, that's part of the game, right? Whatever. I mean, I can be fiery. Yeah, I've been told.
Do you care what people think? Like living in our world, like in radio lands, every 6 to 8 weeks there's a ratings, you know, good, bad or indifferent. You're either off for a celebration or you're off for a
commiseration.
Yeah. But with you guys, it's like you find out the next morning. Just after 9 o'clock, right, roughly. Is that hard for you to live on that sort of every day there's a scoreboard?
I'm okay with it because our scoreboard's been pretty good this year. So
ask me,
you know, when that changes, if that changes, and my answer might be different. Like you talk about, do I care what people think? Like yes, I do. Like if you don't care what your audience thinks of you, then how utterly disrespectful and you shouldn't be doing the job. But what's different to that is what I don't pay any attention to is trolling or comments on social media.
Yeah.
That I give absolutely no time to. And that I feel is very different. I'll read emails. If someone writes in an email, and I'm happy with criticism. Criticism is fine, but, you know, you've seen it. We've all seen it.
Yeah.
When that crosses the line. And I often then think of, okay, who's that person at home who – feels the need to be so vile, someone whose things ain't going so well in their life right now.
Yeah.
And you know, I know we all hate it, but talking about COVID, and I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about that time frame when there was a lot of angst. And I think, you know, people would see Carl and I going in every morning doing our job, so it looked like our life didn't change that much. And we're having a laugh because, you know, hell, you got a bloody laugh, you know, when you're going through that. If you can't laugh, then it's all over. Mm. And so I think we're a trigger point for people and, you know, and some of the stuff that would come in. But I would just go, okay, I don't see it, but I needed someone else to read it to make sure because, you know, when there's stuff about your kids and there's about, then I don't want to, if something then happened and it's like, well, hang on, it was there and I didn't see it. So I just handed that over and it's like, I don't want to see it. I don't want to be part of it. But so that I could happily I tune that out really easily. You just don't read it.
Yeah.
You know? You open the comments section about something about yourself. No, you're not going to typically like everything that's there, right? So why do it?
And why wouldn't there be 100 things saying, Ali, you did such a great job, and then somewhere in the middle.
One person
and
says,
then we focus on that one nasty one and you're like, what about the 99 goodies?
Yeah.
I remember Mark Geyer, who I was on the radio with in my first gig in radio, he said to me, just block, delete, mate. Block, delete. Don't worry about it. don't worry about it. And people would come along in the car and they might have a crack because my job on the grill team was to take that on a little bit because I hadn't won a premiership, I hadn't won State of Origin. So I was sort of that fan guy. So they gave it to me and then so it meant the public felt they could give it to me as well. And then Maddie would just go, hey, mate, they know who you are. You don't know who they are. Don't worry about it. But it took a while. And I'm a softie at heart. Yeah. I wear my heart on my sleeve. And I was just like, he said, never worry about anyone bagging you unless they've met you and bagged you. Then you can make a decision on whether or not you care. Otherwise, they're just making it up. They don't know who you are.
Yeah.
But that takes a little, you know, a little bit of time to get that headspace right.
And it takes time. And it takes time for us as adults, right? And then,
yeah.
So, you know, you shave a couple of years off and you're back in high school and that's all happening and that's when it's really rough.
Yeah.
That's when it's really rough. So
very true.
Anyway, we're tough. We're tough.
Yeah, we're toughish, yeah. And we've got a village around us to help us. That's the key. So we've jumped from Darwin, 60 Minutes, fantastic, and we've gone to a current affair. But in the middle there, there's a bit of stuff going on. Getting up early mornings, that's where you and I first met. Today Show. I just remember walking on the Today Show set and it was fun. You know, you and Carl got along well. Mm. The crew were always very respectful, but there was a feeling like you're all in a team.
Yep.
There was no sort of hierarchy, which I loved. Did you enjoy your time on the Today Show, getting up early? And was it a big decision to have to go a current affair?
Yeah, that was a big decision and I'll get to that one. But those three fantastic years, like just, and I think I was okay with the, I'm not much of a sleeper anyway. And I think my body clock, I naturally wake up at around like the 2:30 mark. So between 2 and 2:30. So I was sort of, I was never in a deep sleep when my alarm went off at 3 a.m. in the morning. Mm. So you just, and I just up and roll out. And because I had a new baby, she was 6 months, 7 months old, and then a 2-year-old, I was used to just, you know, boom, there's a noise, up you get. I mean, I'm up and in the car driving before I've even woken up.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I do remember the very first morning the alarm went off I don't even think it did. I think I got up before the alarm. But I jumped in the shower and I think I'd made so much noise that, you know, both kids woke up. And then I just remember like walking out the front door going like, sorry, honey, and leaving him with it. And it was agreed after day one that maybe they wouldn't, you know, just up, clean your teeth. Slip out. I went to work in my pajamas every morning.
Right.
Which then, also, like, why would you get changed twice?
Yeah.
What a waste of time getting up, getting dressed at 3 to work.
What about when you finish it at the end of the show? Did you get back in your jammies to get home?
No. You always take actual clothes.
Okay. So that's for you for afters.
Well, only, but not always. That came about because as you're leaving in the lift, all of a sudden, you know, you swing past the CEO and you're back in your UGG boots and your PJs. And you only do that once.
Yeah,
and then
you're
all right. Okay.
Yeah.
We bring my day clothes.
Yeah. So you had three lots of clothes by the time you sort of 10 o'clock hit every morning. You're in your third set.
Yeah. I was also about 10 coffees in. So, I mean, woo!
Well, I remember the atmosphere was great, as I've said. You had a nasty knee injury through that as well. So you had that operation and you're in a, you know, what do they call it? A brace?
I was in a brace for
ages.
Three different operations. So I think the first brace was a couple of months and then the third op was another big one and it was like locked straight in the brace for
six weeks.
It's what it is. So I was at rehab this morning and I'll be rehab on Thursday. So
this is just a part of your life now.
Yeah, but you know, it's one of those things, right, that it gave me a great respect and understanding of people who live with chronic pain. I don't know how they, you know, at least I always knew that I'd reach a point where, and I have bad days with this, but I also have good days. And so you just have to, you know, rather than kind of mourn the stuff that you can't do anymore, I just shift it. So I swim more and Pilates and things, but, you know, I can't go for, you know, I'm not going to go for a run. But look, I never enjoyed running. So in some ways, it's fine.
It's life
but what I miss, but what I miss is, you know, I can't jump and things. So I miss not like kicking a footy around with the kids in the backyard.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff. And, you know, and even now and the kids, you know, jump on me in the lounge. It's like, which ones you saw, like, mum?
Oh.
But it's in the scheme of things and it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, some days it hurts. And now you just like, I even just use a different language around it. Like, it feels different today rather than, you know, it hurts.
Good or bad.
So that's okay. And look, you know, and my very first day back at work after that accident, because I think it was the first day ratings that I did it and I was off for a month. It was meant to be 6 weeks.
How did you do that? Is it embarrassing, the story? How you heard it?
Oh, my gosh.
Can you tell?
Oh, no, it's just on a hydrofoil. So Carl and I were racing up on the Gold Coast. And I'd even sent him, I was so cocky because it's like, he's going to be shit at this. So I'd sent him into the water like half an hour before me to practice. And then we had a race and I won the race. His argument was I had a weight advantage. And then I was just sort of fooling around on it, you know, afterwards and just did a little turn thing on it to bring it back in and just, I could fall off it 1,000 times the same way and I wouldn't be able to do the same injury. You just couldn't. So I was just bloody unlucky. And the very first morning I came back to work, Carl came down to get me out of the car. And
I remember that.
Yeah, and because the cameras were there. Anyway, yeah. Day two when the cameras weren't there, Carl wasn't there.
Yeah. See you in the studio.
See you in the studio. But no, I mean, you've seen Carl and I in that studio. Yeah, I mean, awesome. I love it. I love that whole team. And that was the hardest thing about leaving the Today Show was that I loved that team.
Mm.
On camera, behind the scenes. Yeah. It's just really, really good people.
Yeah, good fun. So to leave that, was it just too good an opportunity? So you went, I've got to take this.
And I just, it's that thought of, it does take it out of you getting up at 3 a.m. every morning. And I even just found with the kids, I wasn't there in the mornings. I was there in the afternoon to pick up from school. But I'm on work conferences at 3:15, another one at 5:15. And, you know, at 5 o'clock I'm watching the Channel 10 news, I'm cooking dinner. So, you know, and then at 5:30 everyone's phones have to go off and everyone's at the table and we're all eating dinner at 5:30 because at 6 o'clock I've got to turn the 6 p.m. news on and then you're doing briefs. It was, and I think that's what it was like, so living with me
so
in the afternoon.
You don't just rock up. You just don't rock up in the morning.
No, well, only,
you're doing all this
only,
preparation.
Only one of us can rock up in the morning, though. He just, he always clocks it,
doesn't
he? Because
I've stayed at Carl's place and he wasn't watching anything.
And he wasn't on any of those meetings either. But no, that goes to what we're talking about, me at high school, right? That's reverting back to that. I'm organized. And Carl can come in and just sit confidently at that desk and just be him. I can only come in and do that if I've done all this work behind the scenes. And, you know, Carl will give me a hard time sometimes. Like I read everything and I write notes on everything, like on my folder and all. But then every now and again, you do an interview where someone would just sort of freeze. And I don't know what to say. And then I just rattle off. Well, that's because you and your neighbor did blah, blah, blah. And then you did da, 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 da. And then that's when I turned to Carl and going, and that's why you read the briefs. Yeah. So you,
yeah.
But it was just a team thing that worked really, really well. And, you know, what he could do in the mornings that I never could. He'd walk in and he could just, like, you know, he's a machine in that he could flick through 4 papers in 10 minutes and just go, that, that, that. He understood what a story was and he could spot it straight away. I don't have that skill set. That takes me, and, you know, I get bogged down in you know, in articles that are really interesting. And but he can do that and he can see it and then sort of shape where the show goes. Mm. About 6:30, we've been on air for about an hour, I start to see it, but I can't do that.
Yeah.
In the morning. So, yeah. And I don't need to because he did, and he didn't need to read his briefs because I did, you know?
Perfect combo.
It worked. It worked.
So, leaving him and the crew was hard.
Hard.
But a current affair, you've had good results, you're happy.
I love it. I love it. And it's almost like we're doing live interviews many nights. So, I sort of feel that's that element of Today's Show, which I loved. And I'm out on the road filming pieces and being able to give it some time. So that's sort of almost like the combination of, you know, what I missed from 60 days combined with, you know, the best parts of the Today Show. So, and the hours are a shitload better.
Yeah. Is it better for, I was going to ask you about the balance with hubby and
it's
kids.
Great. Yeah.
And how that all works and the fact you need to have a village at home. Like I did 10 years of Brekkie Radio. Like Vic's got those kids up and Adam breakfast, to the bus or to school every day. Then I did the Arvos and I loved that and that was my time.
Yep.
But you definitely need a partnership, a village around you to help you. Mm. What's it like for you guys and your family?
It's so much easier. I think just I'm present, but present and not tired or distracted. So I don't even call work until I walk the kids to school in the morning. And TV doesn't go on in the morning. I'll sneak like my AirPods and have my phone just so I can watch a bit of the Today Show just to see what, you know, what they're up to and what the main stories are.
Yeah.
But there's no, that's like the rule in the morning. So as soon as we're ready, we just play. And so I have sort of, you know, a solid 3 hours in the morning with them. That's real quality time, you know, where it's
you're present.
You're present. And I'm not having to, you know, and morning's right. Like you know, everyone's trying to get ready for work and school and rushing around. And so there's lots of yelling and hurry up and all. Like I literally could walk them to school in my pajamas. You know, I don't, but
yeah.
I may probably have once or twice. But so I'm not having to, there's nothing that I need to rush for. And then as soon as I drop them off, we ride scooters and bikes and do the drop off and talk to the other parents and hopefully see the teachers and say hi. Then I check in with work and, you know, that part sort of goes about that way. I was saying to someone the other day, it's like, oh, the kids are just at that great age. They're 4 and 6. They're, you know, they're just not all that squabbling and that real, you know, that real whingy. And Mike's like, yes, they do. You're just not around for witching hour. Yeah, like, you know, you just get the delightful little darlings to come in and curl into bed with us. And mummy, you know, I just love your cuddles. Because he deals with bath time and dinner time and I'm not eating my vegetables. So
is he a good dad?
Extraordinary.
Right. So you got a good one.
He's a better parent than me.
Okay, that's cool.
Can't believe I've just said that on the record.
Is that a patience thing?
He would also say, I know. would be his answer.
He wouldn't hesitate.
And all our friends and family would go, yes, that's true.
That's a given.
Yeah.
Did he fall in love with you or did you fall in love with him first? Was it love at first sight? Like, how did that relationship start?
We met the old-fashioned way drunk in a pub.
Similar age?
No, he's 10 years older than me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah. He doesn't look it, though.
No, he's a good-looking rooster.
He's a pretty good-looking rooster. Yeah. I've got to
say. You go okay, too.
Edie married for 16 years tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Mm. Have you got a prezzy already or?
No, well, see, he was off surfing on a 3-weekend, he says 2-week, I say 3-weekend surf trip in May, and he missed Mother's Day and my birthday, and there was squat diddly. Yeah, so I'm just home solo parenting while he's off surfing Indo somewhere. And there wasn't a card. There
Not
wasn't a
message,
present.
No FaceTime.
Kids woke up, didn't even know it was Mother's Day. Oh, so, wow. No, so he gets
diddly
jacked tomorrow is what he gets.
With a nice see you later,
As I
mate.
Say, I'm not mad. I'm just upset.
Yeah, it's all right. I'm just disappointed.
Just disappointed,
mate.
I was disappointed for the kids.
Yeah.
You denied the kids.
And you know
that.
What? It's unlike you or my wife to remember things like that either and bring it back at the right time.
I'm sure someday soon I'll forget it.
Yes.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's good. So, I mean, the fact that he's 10 years older, you meet in a bar, did you sort of go, oh,
yeah,
he's interesting? Or did you go, oh?
I went, oh.
Okay. Yeah. There was an oh. Okay. And did he feel the same?
Yeah. I think so. Well, yeah, obviously. Well, come on.
I mean, obviously, but you never
know. I was 10 years younger. I mean, should think himself lucky.
So how much after that night in the pub did you think, oh, this bloke's like not just going out material, he could be hubby material?
That's right. Well, you know, we chatted, like I was with a bunch of Channel 9 people and because he used to work with quite a few of them. So he knew those guys. But he dropped me home in a taxi that night and he called at like 10 o'clock the next morning and we went out for lunch that day.
Wow.
So this whole thing where you wait 3 days and you do or you play it cool.
No.
Neither of us played it cool.
Yeah.
It was just, and then I think we were at a dinner party about 6 months later and someone asked how we met and it's like I just had this, you know, this physical reaction to this guy that he walked in and he's like black jeans and his red t-shirt and I tell this whole story and Mike just goes, I've never owned a red t-shirt. So we now laugh that, you know, I met the love of my life that night, but I married Mike.
Yeah, exactly. That guy's out there somewhere.
Somewhere. One day, I'm sure I'll find him again.
One day. Now, we could talk literally forever, but Ali, we've got a thing to end the podcast, which is called The Fast Five. Mm-hmm. And the first one of those is your favourite quote. Is there a quote that you heard or that you live your life by?
I love this one. Do one thing every day that scares you.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Do you know that's Eleanor Roosevelt?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
She would have seen some stuff.
A lot of stuff. So look, I don't do something every day that scares me, but I like that idea.
Yes. And I reckon you seem to be the type of person, if you did have a choice of doing that, you would.
Always.
You just may not have that sort of opportunity pop up every day.
Yeah.
But when you do, you'll take it on.
Oh, I take it on. Because I remember a story I did for 60 Minutes when I went swimming with great white sharks with no cage. And Mike said to me, like, I'm just wondering why you want to do it. And it was like,
it's a fair question.
I can't think of anything that would scare me more where we chum the water, get sharks around us and then jump in. And it's like, I can't think of anything that scare me more than that. So if I can do that, I can do anything. That was my theory behind it. Until you're on the boat and they chum the water and the guy, Mike Rutson, who we're doing the story with in South Africa, goes, okay, we've got good sharks. Let's go. And it's like, I don't want to do this anymore. And, you know, I turned to the camera right before I jumped in because the 60 crew, they didn't jump in with me. I went on my own with this guy. And I turned around to the camera and they thought, oh, she's about to say something really profound. And I said, tell my husband if I die to mourn me forever and never remarry, I put my regulator back in and jumped in the water. And they're all, oh, that's a dick move.
Yeah.
That's, like, if that's genuinely her last words, that's mean.
So how close?
I was confident I was coming back.
How close did those sharks get to you?
Like, whiz overhead. You blow bubbles so they'd, yeah.
So would you do that sort of stuff again?
No.
Right.
Don't
so
need
what,
to.
What made you do it?
Oh, just that I couldn't think of anything that scared me more. So why wouldn't I do that? And I trusted the guy, my
Now
Brunson.
You've got kids, though, you wouldn't do it. Is that a good enough excuse now?
Yeah, and you know, and before I had kids, I hated that idea of like, well, why wouldn't I just, and it's like, no, I would never do that now.
No, don't put yourself
in
that.
I'm a lot older and a little bit wiser.
Yes, I'm a bit same. Favourite holiday destination?
You know what? I mean, I would actually say Mum and Dad's farm because the kids said that the other day and it's like, you know, they've gone to Fiji and we take them to Noosa and Port Douglas and different places and the snow and it's like, where's your favourite holiday destination? Nanny and Poppy's farm. And it's just...
Best.
It is just the best. You just lock in and everything's there and family's there.
And they feel safe and trust everyone.
I know.
Love that. Favourite book?
Ooh.
Have you got an author that you go, oh, I must
you
read
know
them
what?
All?
I love James Michener, and we're going back a while now. So, I mean, The Source is probably one of my favourite books ever of his. I also like he wrote The Drifters, which was a really good book. And one that I read in the last couple of years that I really liked was A Gentleman in Moscow, Amor Towles.
Okay.
It was a great
Do you read a lot?
Read. I love reading.
Okay. So that's if you're on a holiday, you grab a book and you'll get to the end of it by the end of the week sort of thing?
Well, I start a book at the end. And then read it from the start.
Sorry. What? What do you mean you start at the end?
I read the end first. Otherwise, I don't sleep. I need to know how it ends. And I read the synopsis of every movie before I ever watch a movie. So then I know if I know what's going to happen, then I'm fine.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So
drives my husband nuts.
Oh, so if you're watching a TV series, you need to know what happens at the end so you can just relax your way through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I don't like watching TV series because obviously, you know, as each one comes out and...
Yeah, it's different.
I can't cope with the... when I get all worked up and don't know how something's going to end and just... And then I can't sleep. No, I can stay awake all night.
You're not a great sleeper.
No, I'm not. So
at the best of times.
So if I know how something ends, then I can enjoy it. Like, not like only a book that if it's like a whodunit, like... I need to know who did it.
Yeah. So when he comes
in. And Mike's like, what's the freaking point of reading it? It's like, well, I can enjoy it now and I feel smarter than all of you because I know the answer.
So at page 10 when Gary the Butcher, Gary, we know what you do.
It was obvious on page 10.
So obvious. That's bizarre. Favourite movie?
I like the oldies and I love musicals. So I'd say Singing in the Rain.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
Gene Kelly, Debbie Reynolds.
How good. And your favourite charity. So we've got $10,000 here from Shaw & Partners and Earl and Au, who are just fantastic, generous people. They want to help. So is there a charity that you can give $10,000 to that will make a difference? And what difference would that be?
The most wonderful charity. It's called the Mirabelle Foundation. And it exists on an oily rag and the work that it does. So basically what it does is it looks after kids who've been orphaned by their parents' drug use. And it's trying to keep them in the family unit. So this might be they've lost mum and dad, they've lost their lives, or they're in jail. And it's keeping them within the family unit and providing that support for the family unit so they don't end up in foster care and institutionalised care. And they've done so much brilliant work. So we run these camps and you see all these kids come in and they're shy and, you know, they've got a lot of challenges in life. And then you see them then at the end of the week or the end of a weekend. And once they realise that they're not the only kid in this situation and they sort of open up to each other and they make friends, and you see now you go back to these camps and kids who sort of started coming there when they were little and now who have grown up and they're 18 or in their 20s are now coming back and volunteering at these camps because it made such a big difference to them.
That's the gold.
And they are beating the drug cycle within one generation.
Wow.
And that's really hard to do. And it's, you know, Jane Rowe started it. She's this extraordinary woman. with just the biggest heart. And it's not one of your big charities, but the work they do and the team involved. So 10K to Mirabel will make an enormous difference. So thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Thank you to Shore and Partners. They're quite extraordinary for
doing this. They really are. This is the only podcast in the world that gives guests money to give to their chosen charity. So that's a beautiful spot for that 10,000 to go to. And Ali, thanks so much for just, you know, chatting away with us today. And
we can both talk underwater, Gus.
We certainly can, with a mouthful of marbles as well. Ali, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Gus.
Cheers, mate.
I hope you enjoyed that episode with Ali Langdon. I certainly did. If you're listening to this, you can also watch it. We've got a YouTube channel because we've filmed the podcast as well. So hopefully you get a chance to look at that. Next week, we've got another wonderful guest. Hope you're enjoying the series.